Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, 20. Honor of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Tim Getman, Jeff Allen, Richard Roman, Thomas Penny, Drew Copas, Tim Carlin, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Ken Jackson, Danny Gavigan, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Joe Brack, Karen Carbone, Johan Detweiler, James Konacek, and Nathaniel Perry. Chihuahua, Mexico sweltered under a brutal summer sun. The temperature was over 110 degrees. Dogs, too exhausted by the heat to chase each other, lay panting in what scant shade there was. Colonel Emilio Vasquez sat in a cantina called El Gato, enjoying its quiet coolness. He was second in command of the rurales. Local law enforcement officers made up primarily of uneducated men too lazy to work at honest labor and too cowardly to steal openly. Sergeant Juan Garcia, a huge bear of a man weighing almost 300 pounds, was drinking with Emilio Vasquez.
Madre de Dios, es muy caliente.
Juanito, if you and I eat everything that did not eat you first, you wouldn't have to complain about the heat so much.
But my colonel, the food, she tastes so good.
Vasquez sneered as his eyes caught a stain on the floor by the bar covered with sawdust. He thought back to the incident of the previous week. Vasquez, Garcia, and two other rurales entered the cantina. Three bandidos had raided a nearby ranch, and Vasquez and his men chased them for 2 days. They caught him at noon and brought all three men back into town, draped across their saddles, riddled with rifle bullets. Vasquez was in an irritable mood because the men had been killed before he had had a chance to work on him with his machete.
Geraldo, tequila for me and my men.
Vasquez and his three soldiers walked to their usual table, only to find it occupied by four cowboys. The men had large pitchers of beer on the table and were eating tamales and beans, sopping up the juice with folded over tortillas.
Excuse me, senors, but you are sitting at my table.
There are many places left to sit, senor. Take any of them that pleases you.
Bastardo! You will address a colonel of the Durales with more respect in the future.
The man jumped from his chair as one of his friends at the table tried to restrain him.
We were here first. There is no need for us to move. Find another table, you rurale piece of dog shit.
No one talks to Emilio Vasquez like that.
Not to your face, perhaps. But you should hear what the villagers say about you behind your back.
Oh, and what do they say, my brave friend?
That you rurales are worse than the criminals you pretend to protect us from. You steal more than you're worth, and they laugh at you in your pompous ways when you're not around to hear them.
Vasquez drew the long-bladed machete from its scabbard on his belt in one lightning-quick move. The men at the table kicked back their chairs and reached for their guns. Vasquez's men were faster. After the smoke cleared, four vaqueros lay in spreading pools of blood on the cantina floor. Vasquez kicked their bodies out of the way with his boot and sat at their table.
Geraldo, clean up this mess and bring us tequila muy pronto.
A small smile turned up the corners of Vasquez's mouth as he remembered the moment. He loved to kill with the machete. It was so much more personal than using a pistol or a rifle. It was almost sexual in its intimacy, and it usually caused Vasquez to become so excited that his first action after such a killing was to find a local prostitute and ease himself within her willing body.
Garcia, if you are finished eating, it is time to go. General Sanchez has asked to see me. Probably wants to congratulate me on the swift apprehension of those bandidos last week.
When they arrived at the Rurales command post, Vasquez was summoned into the office of General Arturo Sanchez, his commanding officer. Sanchez was looking out his window with hands clasped behind his back.
Emilio, I have received official complaints about your actions last week.
Oh?
It seems that you killed several workers on Don Gonzalez Rancho.
Oh, that is not true, Your Excellency. His men were drunk and insulted my honor while at the cantina in town. I did not know until later that they worked for Señor Gonzalez.
Well, El Machete, it seems Don Gonzalez has very important connections in Mexico City. He had complained to the governor of this province, and I have been instructed to arrest you on charge of murder.
What? That is not possible.
Because of our long friendship, I will delay execution of my orders until tomorrow. If you happen to desert and leave Chihuahua before then, why, the matter will be solved to both our satisfaction.
Si, mi comandante.
Vasquez left the building to search for the men under his command he knew he could trust. Plans had to be made quickly. That evening, Vasquez and 10 of his most trusted men, all as corrupt and vicious as he, broke into the command stockade. Over 25 murderers and rapists were housed in the jail. Mixed breeds of mestizo and mescalero Apache Indians and half-breeds and several notorious bandidos Vasquez and his men had captured. Vasquez paced back and forth in front of their cells, offering them a chance to escape a firing squad and to ride free, if they promised to obey his orders and ride for him. With nothing to lose, the men all agreed, and Vasquez and Garcia unlocked their cells and provided them with guns and ammunition. While Garcia stole horses and tack from the command post stables, Vasquez slipped into Sanchez's bedroom. He tapped the sleeping man on the shoulder.
Adios, Carbon.
Vasquez rejoined his group of desperados and led them off into the night, heading northwest toward the Rio Bravo and Del Rio, Texas. Along the way, they raided several haciendas for food and money, killing with cold abandon and meeting little resistance. After a long ride, just as the sun was starting its ascent, the riders came upon a ranchito a few miles from the river crossing at Del Rio. The land was dry, and its corn was withered and not worth stealing. There were about 20 head of longhorn cattle milling near the adobe ranch house.
Hey, Juanito, I think we can get some money for those cattle across the border. What do you think?
Si. There is a small town called Braggyville not too far away. I have an uncle who works for a ranch there. He says they always need more cattle.
Ride, vaqueros, ride!
As the bandidos approached, two men ran from a small corral toward the house, trying to make it to safety. Suddenly, a diminutive figure wearing a wide western hat and a brace of Colt strapped down low on his thighs stepped out of the doorway. Bullets began to pop the walls of the house, but he didn't flinch or move. He threw his Henry repeating rifle to his shoulder.
Kill it! Kill the gringo!
His men tried to, firing over 100 bullets at the little man, who remained right where he stood, shooting calmly and accurately until his rifle was empty. When he threw the long gun down, the riders again tried to rush the hut. Suddenly, both the man's hands were filled with iron.
Hey, pull back!
We got the cows! Let's go!
They rode off, herding the group of unruly cows, leaving their dead and wounded where they lay.
That hombre had the cojones del toro!
Or maybe he just plenty loco en la cabeza!
Joey Wells punched out his empties and reloaded both his Colts just in case the crazy marauders returned. Only then did he turn his attention to his wife and son, who lay in a spreading pool of blood on the dirt floor of his house.
Oh, baby, no.
He knelt by his wife's side. She was unconscious, still clasping their 3-year-old son in her arms. One of the bandito's bullets had torn through little Tom's right leg and into Betty's chest. The boy was unconscious as well, and his leg hung at a funny angle. Joey whipped his bandana off and tied it in a tight knot around the leg, slowing the bleeding to a trickle. He rolled Betty on her side, pulled a long, wicked-looking Arkansas toothpick from a scabbard at the rear of his belt, and cut away her dress. The bullet had entered her chest just below her left breast, hit her rib, and skidded around her rib cage just under the skin to exit out her back. There was no bloody froth on her lips, and her breathing was rapid but deep. Joey knew from close association with gunshot wounds that hers was not immediately life-threatening. He took a slab of fat back from the cupboard and placed it over her wound to slow the bleeding and tied it in place with what was left of her blouse. He sat back on his heels, staring at his wife and son and their blood stained in the dirt floor of their home. And he remembered what had happened to his first wife and son. It seemed almost to have happened to someone else instead of him that day in 1858. Joey was young, but men married young in the mountains of Missouri in those days. He was a mountain man, as were his relatives who hailed from the Blue Ridges of Virginia, the peaks of Tennessee, and the broken crags of the Ozarks. The mountains and their ways of life were ingrained blood deep in him. Independence, self-reliance, and strength led to the particular code of the mountain man. To rectify a wrong or seek vengeance for a hurt was as all-important as returning a favor or keeping one's word once given. It was as strong as religion, and sometimes stronger. And the way of the Missouri feud lived as long as the man did. Joey Wells had come to Sutton County, Missouri, and bought 40 acres, a quarter section of bottom land, with soil as black and rich as any in the state. His creek was full, and his crops were growing as fast and tall as his new baby boy. If things continued to go his way, he'd buy the 40 acres adjacent to the one he now tilled. It was mid-morning before Joey smelled smoke on the freshening breeze. He pulled back on the double reins.
Whoa there, mules! Whoa there!
He followed his nose and saw the black clouds rising in giant puffs over the wooded ridge between him and his house.
Gunshots.
His wife and son were in the cabin alone. He had never run so fast in his entire life. He made it to the clearing surrounding his house. The timbers of his cabin were falling in, flames eating what was left of Joey's dream of hearth and home. He scrambled to his feet and charged the fire until he was driven back, his face blistered and burned, his coveralls smoldering from the intense heat. It was almost nightfall before the flames subsided enough for him to search the ruins. He found them in what had been their bedroom. They were lying next to each other, the fire-blackened arms of his baby boy stretched out, his small fingers searching for his mother's, which would remain forever just out of reach. Joey wrapped their bodies in burlap sacks and carried them to a large oak tree near the creek. He dug a single grave and placed them tenderly in the dirt. As the sun sank to the west and the stars broke through scattered clouds, he recited what he could remember of a Christian burial ceremony.
An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth.
As tears made furrows in his soot-blackened cheeks, Joey turned his face upward toward a slender moon.
I will have my revenge! You hear me, God?
Not even you can stay my vengeful hand!
That was the last time Joey Wells cried. Joey shook his head, snapping his mind back to the present. He had work to do if he wanted to save his wife's and his boys' lives. Walking quickly across sun-baked dirt, he went first to check on Carlos and Ricardo, his hired hands. They were both dead, killed instantly in the first rush of battle. Joey turned, wearing a death grimace, pulled his Arkansas toothpick from its scabbard, and walked slowly to check the six bodies lying in various locations around his house. Four were dead, two still breathing but unconscious. He knelt next to the first one, an Apache half-breed.
Who did this? Who's your leader?
I tell you nothing, gringo.
Joey grabbed the wounded man's collar and dragged him over to where the other man lay. This one, a Mexican, was conscious but unable to move. His spine was shattered where a slug had torn through it.
Who's your leader and why did you hit my place?
The man shook his head. Evidently, he wasn't inclined to speak either.
Watch!
Joey pulled the Apache's head up by its hair and quickly sliced off both ears.
Guess it's not true what they say about Injuns not showing any pain, huh?
Joey shrugged and with a lightning quick motion moved his knife around the half-breed's head.
Now, we can do this one of two ways. An easy way and a hard way. My wife and kid are in that house, both shot by you bastards. I hope you choose the hard way.
It was Emilio Vasquez, El Machete, who bring us here. We just wanted your cattle for money.
Where are they heading next?
I don't know, senor.
Joey swung the knife down, penetrating the killer's hand and impaling it to the ground.
You want to try the question again?
Brackenville? They go to Brackenville to sell cattle.
My hand!
Hurts, doesn't it?
See, senor?
Bet it doesn't anymore.
Joey didn't turn to watch the bandit die, drowning in his own blood, but walked rapidly to the corral to attach his two horses to his buckboard. He needed to get his wife and son to Del Rio as soon as he could. The Mexican town of Jimenez was closer and on his side of the Rio Grande, but Joey knew there was no doctor there, at least none he would trust with his family. It took him almost 4 hours to load his wife and son in the buckboard and make the trip to Del Rio. Once there, he was relieved to hear that both would survive, though the doctor couldn't tell if the boy would ever be able to walk on his shattered leg.
It's in God's hands.
I'll leave the healing to him, as long as he leaves the killing to me. Take care of my kin, Doc, till I get back.
But where are you going? Your family needs you.
The look of naked hatred and fury in Joey's eyes stopped the doctor in mid-sentence.
I gotta bury my hands and close up my house. And then I'm gonna kill every mother's son who had a hand in hurting me and mine. You tell Betty in little time I'll be back for him when I'm done. She'll understand. She knows the way of Missouri feud.
Three days later, Joey rode his big roan stallion, Red, into Brackettville. It was a small cattle town 25 miles northwest of Del Rio and a gathering place where ranchers from nearby spreads bought and sold stock of all kinds. Joey was loaded for bear. He wore a brace of Colt 44s tied down low on his thighs, a shoulder holster with a Navy 36 under his left arm, his Arkansas toothpick at his back, and he carried a Henry repeating rifle across his saddle horn and a Greener 10-gauge sawed-off shotgun in a saddle boot. As he rode down the main street now, his eyes flicked back and forth, covering his approach on both sides, including rooftops. It was a habit learned young when after the Civil War he had spent 2 years hunting and killing Kansas redlegs until there were none left. The war and its aftermath had turned young Joey Wells into a vicious killing machine until he met Betty and tried to change his life. Now, he was back on the trail, hunting nature's most deadly animals, other men.
God help me, but I miss this.
His mind drifted back to 1858. It didn't take Joey Wells long to discover who had burned his cabin and killed his wife and son, and why. There had been raids along the Missouri-Kansas border since 1854, but the burning of Wells' cabin had been the first incursion of the Kansas Redleg raids to hit Sutton County. The Redlegs were becoming infamous, leading raiders and killers and rapists into Missouri. Their leaders were infamous as well. Doc Jameson, Johnny Sutter, and a colonel named Waters. These men and the thugs they commanded hid behind a cause, but they really cared only about killing and looting and burning. After burying his family, Joey took to the bush, where he found others like himself, men who had been burned out, families either killed or driven off, men who had lost everything except the need for vengeance. By the time the actual war between the states began, these men and Joey were seasoned guerrilla fighters. Men as at home on horseback or lying covered in leaves and bushes in thick timber as they were around the campfire. They could live for weeks on berries and squirrels and birds, and they could sneak up to a man and steal his dinner from his plate without being seen. They were also mean and deadly as snakes and just as quick to kill. To these warriors, there were no rules, no lines of battle, no command structure. It was simply kill or be killed, but be damn sure to take some with you when you fired your final shot. Finally, Union General Ewing made his biggest mistake of the war. He issued an order to arrest womenfolk, burn their homes, and kill everyone along the Missouri-Kansas border. This caused hundreds, even thousands, to join the guerrilla ranks of the Missouri Volunteers. Names began to be carved into history and legend. Names written in the blood of hundreds of Union soldiers and sympathizers. Quantrill, Bloody Bill Anderson, Dave Johansen, George Tilton, Joey Wells. Mere mention of these men could make grown men blanch and pale, and women grab their children and run for cover. After Union raiders killed a mother and her young son in one of their many raids, her other two sons joined the ranks of the Missouri Volunteers to ride with Bloody Bill Anderson. They were Frank and Jesse James. These two volunteers perfected the art of guerrilla warfare. They used pistols mostly. Riding with reins in their teeth, guiding their mounts with their knees, and a Colt pistol in each hand, they charged forces superior in numbers and weaponry time and time again to defeat them by sheer raw courage and fearlessness. Joey reined Red in before a saloon, which had a sign over the front entrance lettered, "The Bull and the Cow." Joey saw no group of men who could be the ones he was trailing, and he relaxed slightly, ambling to the bar, putting his Henry in front of him, its hammer back.
Whiskey.
The barman placed a bottle in front of him and a glass so dirty he couldn't see through it.
You want me to clean that glass on your shirt?
The bartender blanched and hastily replaced the glass with a clean one.
Give me a bottle with a label on it. I don't want none of this horse piss here.
See? Old Kentucky, okay?
Joey just took the bottle and poured a tumbler full.
Leave the jug.
See?
Joey took the bottle and walked to an empty table in a corner of the saloon. At midnight, a very drunk, fat Mexican staggered down the stairs, an almost empty bottle of tequila in one hand and a sweat-stained sombrero in the other. He wore a Mexican rurale uniform still covered with trail dust. At the bottom of the stairs, he upended the bottle and drank the last of its contents.
Amigo! Over here, por favor.
What do you want, mister?
I got this here whiskey, and I don't like to drink alone. I'd like to know about the girls here. They worth a couple of dollars?
Si, senor. They're not so young. But what do you do in town this small?
Joey signaled the barman for another glass and poured it full when it arrived.
Not so much fire as tequila, but...
Yeah, I know what you mean. Still, gotta get the job done, all right.
My name is Tomas. Tomas Rodriguez.
I'm heading on down Del Rio way. You ever been there?
Oh, si. Much better cantina in Del Rio. Muchas señoritas, muchas tequila.
I'm looking to buy some longhorns. You know anybody down that way might have some to sell?
What, longhorns? Too bad. Mi compadres just sold ours 2 days before.
You mean those cattle Vasquez sold here?
You know Vasquez?
Sure. Old friend of mine. Used to call him El Machete back when I knowed him.
Oh, you been to Chihuahua?
Oh, yeah, once or twice.
Vasquez is not in Chihuahua no more. He's going to Colorado, and I will join him there.
Colorado, huh? Why is old Machete going all the way to Colorado?
Oh, big jefe in Pueblo named Murdoch going to hire us. Needs vaqueros, good with pistolas. You got more whiskey?
Sure. It's across the street at the hotel in my room. Come on, I'll get us another bottle.
Joey threw his arm around the drunk's shoulders and they stepped through the bat wings. He walked the Mexican around the corner of the saloon and into the darkness of an alley.
What? Where are we?
Joey pulled out his Arkansas toothpick and held the point under Rodriguez's chin.
Why for you do this, gringo?
The only reason I ain't killing you right now, you bastard, is I don't want the U.S. law on my trail while I track down and kill your murdering friends.
The knife flashed and severed all four of the fingers on Rodriguez's right hand. Then, with a backhanded swipe, Joey hit him dead in the middle of his forehead with the butt of his knife. After wiping his knife on the man's shirt, Joey walked around the corner to get on red and head towards Pueblo, Colorado.
I thought that was you the barman described, Wells.
Joey's hand was on his pistol butt before he saw who was talking to him. It was Luis Carbone, and standing next to him was his friend and constant companion, Al Martina.
Looks like they'll let any old trash come up to Texas.
You got time to wet your whistle, killer?
Yeah, well, maybe just one. And I gotta be on my way.
Martina raised an eyebrow when he saw Joey's eyes flicker toward the alley.
Your hurry wouldn't have nothing to do with that hombre you escorted out of here, would it?
Joey shook hands with the two men and they went back into the saloon.
Want a beer?
No. Like I said, I gotta get going here before too long. Whiskey'll do me just fine. What are you two doing all the way up here? Last I heard, you was stuck down in Chihuahua entertaining all the senoritas.
No, we came to buy some longhorns from Texas and run them back down to Mexico. Those Mexican crossbred cattle ain't worth spit.
Say, you boys know anything about a galoot named Murdoch ranching up Colorado way?
Yeah. And I hope the fact that you're asking about him means he's gonna die real soon.
Oh?
Yeah, Al's not what you'd call fond of him. About a year back, when we was last up here buying cattle, he got in a poker game with Murdoch and lost half the money we had for cattle.
And later, I heard he ran a crooked game. He cleaned some old boy out of everything he had, including the deed to a ranch somewhere up in the mountain country. Could have been Colorado, I guess.
Last news we had, the Rangers told him to get his butt out of Texas, or they'd make him wish he had.
Oh, don't you worry none about getting any revenge, Al. I'm headed up that way to have a talk with Murdoch and some of the men he's hired.
Joey went on to tell the two about how the Marauders had shot Betty and Tom.
Don't worry about your family, compadre. Al and I will stay here and make sure they are well cared for while you take care of Vasquez and his men. But watch yourself. I hear Vasquez is crooked as a snake's tail and twice as dangerous with that long knife of his.
Thanks, Luis.
If you happen to get up near Big Rock, Colorado, there's someone I'd like you to look up for us.
Yeah, who'd that be?
Man named Smoke Jensen. He did Luis and me a big favor a couple of years back, and I'd like you to take a present from us.
Smoke Jensen? Smoke Jensen the Pistolier?
Come on over to my horse. I have something in my saddlebags for you to take with you.
Smoke and Pearly and Cal rode three abreast across the lush meadows of Sugarloaf, Smoke's ranch. They were riding the pastures and fields to make sure the spring calving hadn't left any cows down, their calves to starve. Spring rains had knocked some fences down, and Pearly and Cal were checking to see which ones needed fixing first, so Pearly could send the punchers out to repair the damage. Out of the corner of his eye, Smoke saw Cal flexing and swinging his left arm.
How's the arm, Cal?
Oh, it's fine, Smoke. No problem at all.
Yeah, it's fine. Except I reckon old Cal will be able to tell us when a storm's coming from the aching in that wound of his.
Cal had only recently recovered from a bullet he took in his chest while helping Smoke in his fight against a man who called himself Sundance. Cal had been as close to death as a man could come and still survive. His wound left him bedridden for 3 months, with Smoke and Pearly taking turns sitting by his bedside, feeding him beef stew and later steaks to build up his strength and help replace the blood he had lost. For his part, Cal never complained about the excruciating pain, just gritted his teeth and forced food down when he wasn't hungry so he could heal faster.
Ooh, he's so proud of that wound, he's even taken to working with his shirt off so the other punchers can see that ugly old scar. Guess he wants them to know he's a genuine pistolier.
Shut your mouth, Pearly. I don't neither.
Why, I reckon the next 4th of July picnic in Big Rock, he'll be parading around bare-chested, asking all the young ladies if they want to touch his famous scar.
Pearly, I swear to God, I'm gonna whoop you if you don't shut your trap.
Smoke's grin faded as he cut his eyes to the side, peering from under his hat brim.
Trouble, Smoke?
Maybe.
Smoke glanced right and left, eyes searching the tree line on either side of the meadow they were riding across.
I saw a reflection off a glass in those trees to the right, and something flushed a covey of quail out of that copse of trees to the left. I hope you boys are loaded up 6 and 6. We need to get to cover. When I give the word, spur your mounts toward that tank up ahead.
Smoke inclined his head at a small pond used to water cattle that lay 100 yards distant. It had been dug by hand and was surrounded by an embankment of earth several feet high on all sides. It wasn't much, but it was all they had.
Now, shag your mounts, boy! Goddamn son of a bitch!
They didn't slow as their broncs jumped the embankment. They shook rives from saddle boots and dove out of their saddles to sprawl against the covering wall of dirt. Each of the men raised their rifle. 6 men rode hard toward Smoke's side. Smoke shot took the lead rider full in the chest. Smoke's next shot took another man in the head. As the other bushwhackers turned their broncs to the side to escape his withering fire, Smoke blasted 2 of them out of their saddle. The other 2 riders finally got their horses turned and were hightailing it for the cover of the trees, leaning almost flat over their saddle horns trying to get to safety. Smoke scrambled to the top of the dirt ridge and took careful aim, elevating the barrel of his long gun until its bead was a foot above one of the fleeing gunmen. The other rider glanced over his shoulder to watch his comrade hit the ground, but he didn't slow his mount as it disappeared into the tree line.
Gotcha, you son of a bitch!
That's it for this side, Smoke! We dusted them all!
You boys all right?
God damn!
Pearly was looking at Cal, who had a red stain on his left shoulder where a bullet took a chunk out of his left arm.
Cal, I swear, boy, you are a regular magnet for lead.
It's okay, it's just a scratch.
Shoot, Smoke. Now we'll never get this boy to wear a shirt.
Pearly, you and Cal go check those glutes and make sure they're all dead. I'll take this side.
And if they're not?
See if you can find out why they jumped us and who sent them.
Only one of the gunmen Smoke shot was still alive.
God damn you, Smoke Jensen. You done killed me.
Not yet, cowboy. But you're close. Now why'd you draw down on me and my men?
For the money. It's funny, Jensen. I'm hit hard, but it don't hurt much.
It will if you last long enough. What money are you talking about?
Jesse found a paper on you in New Mexico. Said it was worth $10,000, alive or dead. Oh, Jesus.
Smoke walked over to the first man he shot. He lay on his back now, arms flung wide, dead face looking somehow surprised. Smoke pulled a folded paper from the ambush's shirt pocket. He wiped blood stains off on the man's shirt and spread it open. It was a wanted poster, dated several years before. There was a drawn picture of a younger Smoke Jensen on it, and the offer of a reward of $10,000 for his capture, dead or alive.
I guess they missed a few of those posters. I wonder how many more are out there drawing bounders to me like flies to molasses.
Smoke walked slowly across the meadow toward the waterhole, detouring slightly to make sure the other three gunhawks were dead. Cal and Pearly had rounded up the men's horses and were waiting for him when he got there.
Any survivors?
No, they's all dead as yesterday's news.
You want us to bury him, Mr. Smoke?
No. Winter storm's coming soon. Wolves and coyotes gotta eat, same as worms. Leave them where they lie. Far as I can see, they don't deserve the sweat of honest men.
It was a typical fall Saturday in Big Rock, Colorado. The town was full of cowboys from nearby ranches come to spend their wages and raise hell. Louis Longmont sat at his usual table in the saloon he owned, playing solitaire and drinking coffee. Louis was a lean, hawk-faced man with strong, slender hands and long fingers. His nails were carefully manicured, and his hands were clean. His hair was jet black, and he sported a pencil-thin mustache. He was dressed, as usual, in a black suit with a white shirt and dark ascot. The ascot, something he'd picked up on a trip to England a few years back. He wore low-heeled boots, shined until they glistened, and he carried a pistol hung low in a tied-down holster on his right thigh. And it was not for show alone, because Louis was snake-quick with a shotgun. A feared, deadly gunman when pushed, he preferred to make his living teaching would-be gamblers how to lose their money at poker when they failed to correctly figure the odds. But this time he reached an impasse in his game and he threw his cards down in disgust. A man entered the bar slowly, stepping to the side when he got inside, so his back was to a wall. He stood there, letting his eyes adjust to the darkened interior of the saloon. Louis recognized the actions of an experienced pistolier, how the man's eyes scanned the room, flicking back and forth. His small gray eyes were as cold and deadly as a snake's, and he wore a brace of Colt 44s on his hips tied down low, and carried a Colt Navy 36 in a shoulder holster. Louis, an experienced gunfighter himself, speculated he had never seen a more dangerous hombre in all his years. The stranger walked then and flipped a gold double eagle on the bar. He took possession of a bottle of whiskey and spoke a few words in a low tone to the bartender. After a moment, the barman inclined his head toward Louis and buried himself wiping the counter with a rag, casting worried glances at Louis out of the corner of his eye. The newcomer turned, leaning his back against the bar, and stared at Louis. His eyes flickered up and down, noting the way Louis had shifted his position and how his right hand was resting on his thigh near the handle of his Colt. His expression softened, and his lips moved slightly, turning up into what may have been a smile on any other face. He evidently recognized Louis as a man of his own kind, a brother predator in a world of prey.
You be Mr. Longmont?
Yes, sir, I am. And to whom do I have the pleasure of speaking?
I be Joseph Wells, though most calls me Joey.
Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Wells. Would you care to take a seat and have some food?
I don't mind if I do, thank you kindly.
Louis waved a hand and a young black waiter came to his table.
Jeremiah, Mr. Wells would like to order.
I'll have a beefsteak, cooked just long enough to keep it from crawling off my plate. 4 hen's eggs scrambled and some tomatoes if you have any.
The boy nodded rapidly and turned to leave.
And some cafecito. Hot, black. Strong enough to float a horseshoe.
I like to see a man with a healthy appetite. You have the look of a fellow a long time on the trail.
Oh, that's a fact. All the way from Mexico, pretty near a month now.
The waiter reappeared and placed a coffee mug on the table, filled it with steaming black coffee from a silver server, and added some to Lewis's cup before setting the pot on the table. Wells pulled a cork from his whiskey bottle and poured a dollop of the amber liquid into his coffee. He offered his bottle to Lewis, who shook his head.
Oh, that's mighty good coffee. Sure beats that mesquite bean coffee I've been drinking for the last month.
Lewis nodded, reviewing in his mind what he had heard about the famous Joey Wells. Wells had been born in the foothills of Missouri. He was barely in his teens when he fought in the Civil War for the Confederate Army. Riding with a group called the Missouri Volunteers, he became a fearless, vicious killer, eagerly absorbing every trick of guerrilla warfare known from the mountain men and hillbillies he fought with. After Lee's surrender at Appomattox, Wells's group attempted to turn themselves in. They reported to a Union Army outpost and handed over their weapons, expecting to be sent home like other Confederate soldiers had been. Instead, the entire group was assassinated, all except Wells and a few others who were very late to the surrender site. From a hill nearby, they watched their unarmed comrades being gunned down. Under the code of the Missouri feud, they vowed to fight the Union to the death. After Joey and his men perpetrated several raids upon unsuspecting Union soldiers and camps, killing viciously to fulfill their vow of vengeance, a group of hired killers and thugs known as the Kansas Redlegs was assigned to hunt down the remaining Missouri Volunteers. After several years of raids and counter-raids, Joey was the last surviving member of his renegade group. It took him another year and a half, using every damn trick he had learned to track down and kill all of the remaining Redlegs, over 150 men. Along the way, he became a legend, a figure mothers would use to scare their children into doing their chores, a figure men would whisper about around campfires at night. With each telling, his legend grew, magnified by penny dreadfuls and shilling shockers, until there was no place left in America for him to run to. After the last Redleg lay dead at his feet, Joey was said to have gone to Mexico and set up a ranch there. Rumor had it the Texas Rangers had struck a bargain with him, vowing to leave him in peace if he stayed south of the border. After his food was served, Wells leaned forward and ate with a single-minded concentration, not speaking again until his plate was bare. He filled his empty coffee cup with whiskey and leaned back.
Oh. A while back, I met some fellas down Chihuahua way, told me about a couple of friends theirs in Colorado. One was named Longmont.
Lewis motioned to the waiter to bring him some brandy, and then he nodded, waiting for Wells to continue.
Yeah. Said this Longmont dressed like a dandy, talked real fancy. But not to let that fool me. This Longmont was a real bad pistolier, knew his way around a Colt. Was maybe the second fastest man with a shotgun they'd ever seen.
These men say anything else?
Said this Longmont would do to ride the river with. If he was your friend, he'd stand toe-to-toe with you against the devil himself if need be.
Well, excusing your friends for engaging in a small amount of hyperbole, I suppose their assessment of my character is basically correct.
Like they said, you talk real colorful-like.
And who was the other man your friends mentioned?
Hombre named Smoke Jensen. They said Jensen was so fast he could snatch Double Eagle off a rattler's head and leave change for the snake could strike.
Your friends have quite a way with words themselves. Might I ask what their names be?
Couple of Mexes named Luis Carbone and Al Martinez. Got him a little ranchito down near Chihuahua. They'd be pretty fair with short guns themselves, for Mexes.
How are Carbone and Martinez doing?
They're pretty fair. Ain't much for ranching, though. Spend most of their time drinking tequila and shagging every senorita within 100 miles. Most of the senoras, too, I expect.
That would certainly be like Alan Luis, all right.
They said they owed you and Jensen a debt of honor for how you helped him out a while back.
Wells reached into a leather pouch slung over his shoulder on a rawhide thong. Lewis tensed, his hand moving toward his Colt. Wells noticed the motion and shook his head slightly.
Now don't you worry none, Mr. Longmont. I ain't here to do you or yourn any harm. I'm just delivering something for Carbone and Martinez. A token of their appreciation, they called it.
He opened his pouch and took out a set of silver spurs with large pointed star rowels and hand-tooled leather straps, and a large shiny bowie knife with a handle inlaid with silver and turquoise.
The knife's for Jensen. The spurs are for you.
Lewis was about to tell Wells thanks when the bat wings opened and two men cradling greener 10-gauge shotguns stepped through the door. Wells straightened and half rose from his chair, his hands hovering over his Colt's, until Lewis put a hand on his shoulder.
That's all right, Joey. They're friends of mine. You're no danger in my establishment.
As Wells sat back down, Sheriff Monte Carson and his deputy, Jim, approached their table.
Everything all right here, Lewis?
Certainly, Monte. Why do you ask?
A couple of punchers came over to the jail, said Joey Wells was in town. They said it looked to them like he was loaded for bear and had some business with you.
Unhand those scatterguns, and you and Jim join us for some coffee. Mr. Wells here and I were just having a pleasant conversation about Luis Carbone and Al Martina.
Carbone and Martina? Last I heard, those two reprobates were down in Mexico trying to raise longhorns. You gotta be smart as a rock to try and herd longhorns.
About all they seem to be raising at the present time is hell, according to Mr. Wells.
Now, Mr. Wells, I'm Monte Carson, sheriff of Big Rock. This is my deputy, Jim Morris. I hope we're gonna be friends and that you're not planning any excitement here in my town.
Sheriff, I've been on horseback for over a month now. The only excitement I plan to find is a bed for me and a rub down some grain from a hoss.
I hope you won't take any offense at my nosiness, but just what brings you to Big Rock?
No offense taken, sir. Well, I reckon it's your job. You got a right to ask. Well, about 6 weeks back, a group of Mexican rurales and a half-breed Mescalero Apaches raided my ranch down in Mexico. It just crossed the border from Del Rio. They killed two of my hands, wounded my wife and son, and stole 20 of my beeves.
They shot your wife and kid?
Yeah. Soon as the raiders were gone, I took Betty and little Tom across to Rio Bravo in Del Rio and had the doc there patch him up. I still don't know if my boy's gonna be able to walk. They shattered his leg bone with a rifle bullet.
How many were there that attacked you?
30, maybe 35. I was a mite too busy to count them at the time. They left 6 for the buzzards to eat at my place.
That why you're up this way?
Yep. After I got my kin taken care of, I tracked the murdering bastards to a town called Brackettville, where they sold my cattle. One of them stayed behind to sample the nightlife. He told me he and the others had been hired by a man named Murdoch to work a ranch over in Pueblo, Colorado. Seems this Murdoch won the ranch in a crooked poker game just before he was run out of Texas by some rangers who didn't like his back-shooting ways.
I've heard of Jacob Murdoch. The ex-sheriff of Pueblo is a friend of mine. He says Murdoch is crooked as a snake's trail. According to my friend, Murdoch's men threatened to kill the townspeople if they didn't vote for his kid brother, Sam Murdoch, for sheriff.
Your friend would be Ben Tolson?
Yeah. Ben told me that ever since Murdoch took over the ranch, the Lazy M, he calls it, there's been complaints of cattle and calves missing and turning up on Murdoch's spread.
Didn't Tolson investigate the complaints?
Sure, but witnesses against Murdoch had a nasty habit of getting themselves killed before they could testify against him. And for long, Ben was out of a job. You got a tough row to hoe if you're planning to go up against Murdoch, especially if he's got 30 new gunhawks on his payroll and his brother is sheriff.
It don't matter none to me. Better men than this Murdoch been trying to plant me for years. I'm still forked in down and all of them are food for worms.
Wells looked up then, eyes narrowed. A man entered, dressed in buckskin shirt and trousers, wearing a brace of Colt 44s tied down low, the left-hand gun butt forward. He stopped just inside the door and paused to let his eyes adjust to the semi-darkness, just as Wells had before. He was a few inches over 6 feet tall, with massive shoulders and arms straining his buckskin shirt. His eyes were as blue as spring skies and cold as winter ice, and his hair was blonde. Wells knew without asking that he was looking at a man as famous and as deadly as he was.
Howdy, Smoke. Come join us.
Smoke stood there, his eyes appraising Wells while he waited to be introduced. He nodded greetings to Monty and Jim.
Smoke Jensen, meet Mr. Joey Wells.
Oh, pleased to meet you, Mr. Jensen.
Likewise, Mr. Wells. If only half of what I've heard about you is true, I hope your visit to Big Rock is a social one.
I've heard a mite about you, too.
Wells picked up the bowie knife from the table and handed it to Smoke.
Luis Carbone and Al Martinez send their regards.
Carbone and Martine, huh?
Yeah. Said this was to remind you they still owe you a debt, and to let them know if you ever need them.
Smoke hooked another chair from a nearby table with his boot and pulled it over. The waiter appeared with a fresh pot of coffee and a handful of mugs. While they drank their coffee, Smoke and Wells talked cattle talk, discussing the difficulties of raising longhorns in Mexico and shorthorns in Colorado. From their conversation, one would never know they were two of the most feared gunfighters in this territory. Wells managed a laugh or two when Smoke and Lewis recounted some tales of Carbone's and Martinez's exploits during the Lee Slater fracas of a few years back. Smoke got the feeling Wells hadn't had much to laugh about for some time. He also found, to his surprise, that he liked the man. Wells was straightforward, with none of the arrogance or swagger seen in most shooters Smoke had met. After a while, saying they had rounds to make, Monty and Jim left. While Smoke ate his breakfast, Lewis gave him a short version of why Wells came to Colorado.
You figuring on going up against Murdoch and his gang alone?
I don't know no other way. One thing I learned in the war, sometimes a lone man can do more damage than an entire brigade.
Yeah, you're probably right. If this Murdoch is as crooked as Monty says, he's most likely got his ranch set up like a fort. A frontal assault wouldn't stand a chance of succeeding. And his brother, the sheriff, would be sure to warn him if a group of strangers showed up.
One man, though, slipping in under cover of darkness could be in and out before they knew what hit him.
Getting in won't be the problem. Getting out is another matter.
I figured to take some lead, all right. But if word gets around in Mexico that you can shoot up Joey Wells and not pay the price, then I'm as good as dead anyhow.
Well, there is that to consider. However, if you're not in too big a hurry to kill those bandidos, I'd be proud to have you spend a day or two out at Sugarloaf.
Well...
It's a long ride to Pueblo, and you don't want to take on that bunch until you're well rested.
And you won't find a better cook or hostess in Colorado than Sally Jensen.
You gents talked me into it.
I'll go to see Monty about some wanted posters on me that are still floating around New Mexico. It shouldn't be more than half an hour or so.
Wells reached into his pocket, but Lewis held up his hand.
There's no charge for the food. Consider yourself my guest as long as you're in town, Mr. Wells.
Like I said, my friends call me Joey.
Wells and Smoke walked outside, and Smoke pointed out the livery stable before he turned to walk toward Monty's office. Wells stepped into his saddle and began to walk his big roan stallion down the street, eyes searching rooftops and alleys at a lifelong habit. As he passed the general store, he saw a figure step out of the shadows, a rifle to his shoulder pointing at Smoke's back. Smoke crouched and wheeled, his hands full of iron. He saw Wells' pistol leaking gun smoke, still aimed at the bushwhacker as he finally toppled backward. Monty and Jim came on the run with greeners leveled at Wells.
Hold on, Monty! Joy saved my life!
A crowd gathered around the body as Smoke bent to check him for life. He was dead as a stone.
This is one of the gang of bounty hunters that attacked me this morning.
Bounty hunters? There's no bounty on you.
Smoke pulled the folded poster from his shirt pocket and handed it to the sheriff.
It's a long story. Go on over to your office and I'll fill you in.
Before leaving, he stuck out his hand and stared into Wells' eyes.
Joey, I owe you.
Never could abide back shooters.
I guess this means you're going to help him go up against Murdoch.
Smoke grinned without answering, his face alive with savage anticipation. Sally and Joey hit it off immediately. Perhaps she saw in the small, proud man the same qualities that had attracted her to Smoke Jensen. His independence, his refusal to allow anyone to hurt his family or friends without paying the price, and his complete lack of pretension and arrogance. For his part, Sally reminded Joey of his wife, Betty. Fiercely loyal to her man, she accepted without question any friend of Smoke's as a friend of hers. And nothing was too good for the gentleman who had saved her lover's life. Sally outdid herself with supper, stuffing the two men with beefsteak, homemade biscuits, and fresh vegetables from her garden until they couldn't eat another damn bite. After the meal, she shooed him out to the porch with mugs of rich, dark coffee and cigars while she cleaned the kitchen. Smoke called Cal and Pearly from the bunkhouse to meet his guest, and the two young cowboys were thrilled to make the acquaintance of such a living legend. Cal even brought over a couple of dime novels written by Ned Buntline that had Joey's picture on the cover, blowing away a group of Kansas redlegs. Smoke laughed when Joey blushed, embarrassed by the teenager's obvious hero worship. The pistolier finally got serious and looked directly into Cal's eyes.
Cal, killing a man ain't hardly never nothing to be proud of. No more than killing a rattler is. Truth is, every one of those redlegs forfeited their right to live by what they done in the war. Now, killing in a war, face-to-face in battle, is one thing. And I don't have no hard feelings against any soldier, blue or gray, who fought with honor. But redlegs turned their backs on honor and gunned down unarmed men and boys who'd given up their weapons and surrendered.
Tell us what happened, Mr. Wells. How did you let them get the drop on you?
Well, it had been a long, cold war, boy. My men and I had been living in our saddles for what seemed like months. No word of back home or kinfolk, nothing. We'd been living like animals. Hunted. Running when we had to, only to stop and turn occasionally and attack back at them when they was least expecting it. The Redlegs raided and burned Dayton, Missouri. We retaliated by doing the same thing to Aubrey, Kansas. They dogged our tails all the way back to the mountains on that little fracas. We slept in our saddles or in the timber under bushes and leaves and grass, shivering, never daring to unsaddle our horses. Slept with the reins in our hands most of the time. Covered our horses' hooves with burlap or cloth to muffle the noise they made. And tried to slip through the Indian nations back to Texas. Had to take some time to heal our wounded and replace our grub and ammunition.
When you got safely back to Texas, why didn't you just stay there?
'Twarn't the way of it, boy. The Missouri feud don't say you fight till you're tired and hungry and then quit. Nope. The way of the feud is to fight till you win or you die. As the Federates began to lose more and more of their battles, and the Bluebellies began to get thick as fleas on a hound dog along the border, we started to lose some of the best we had. Bloody Bill died with his hands filled with iron. Bill Quantrill was killed in a running gunfight. Lots more, whose names I can't recollect just now, was lost to the feud. And when Lee surrendered at Appomattox, word started circulating and we'd get amnesty pardons if we surrendered. Oh, lots of the boys were getting homesick, wanting to see their mamas and papas and wives again. And we sat round a campfire, talking it up and down and all around. And one of the fellas said he'd been to town. Saw a poster, said if we'd raise our hands and promise not to cause no more grief and be loyal to the Union and turn in our guns, we'd be set free to go on back home. You fought in a war of Smoke. You must know how good that sounded to boys who'd been in the bush fighting for nigh on 3 years or more.
Yeah, after a while it seems you only dreamed about home. And many young men begin to feel it wasn't real. Only the fighting and dying were real.
That's the way it was, all right. Now I sat there around that fire, my hat pulled down low, holding the reins of my horse as I always did, and I thought it over. By then, I was mighty near the oldest and toughest of the bunch, and I knew they was waiting to see which way I'd tilt. I didn't want no more friends to die in my arms or because of me and my feud. I didn't say nothing when old George Tilton told him he was riding in. He got up, stepped into his saddle, and they all to a man followed him. Damn if they wasn't a ferocious-looking bunch of men. And most of us carried three or four pistols, a shotgun or two, maybe a rifle in the saddle boot. Lots of knives, too, but we didn't get to use them overly much. Most of our fighting being from horseback. They stopped when they saw I was still squatting by the fire. Davy Williams asked me if I was going in, and I told him, I reckon not. Tilton tipped his hat and wished me luck, as did the others. They rode off toward the Union camp 5 miles to the south, ready to make their peace and get on home.
Why don't you go, Joey?
Well, that's a hard thing to explain, Pearlie. Guess I just didn't have no place to go home to. My cabin was burnt to the ground, my family all killed. The mountain code I'd always been raised to believe in said you didn't quit a few till your enemies was all dead. And my loyalty was to my dead wife and baby, and my obligations was to the feud. It was as simple and as complicated as that, I guess. One boy stayed with me, Colin Burroughs. He'd been riding with me more than 2 years. He said he didn't have no place to go either.
What happened when the others tried to turn themselves in?
Tilton led our boys right up to the Union camp, hands held high, white kerchiefs tied to the rifle barrels. Colonel Waters and his second-in-command, Johnny Sutter, welcomed them in with big grins on their faces, telling them they was doing a smart thing. Colin and me watched from a ridge overlooking the camp. We stood there in the mist and rain with our hands over our mounts' noses so they wouldn't smell the other horses and nicker. After Colonel Waters got all our boys' guns and such, he walked back to his tent and closed the flap. Guess he didn't have the stomach to watch what was going to happen next. Sutter lined the boys up, told them to raise their right hands and swear allegiance to the Union. While they were swearing, Sutter gave a signal. Some blue bellies pulled up a tarp on a wagon containing a Gatling gun. Their soldiers cranked the handle on that gun and mowed down my boys like they was cutting wheat in harvest.
Shit, what'd you do?
Colin and me swung into our saddles and charged right into that camp, both our hands filled with iron. I put a ball in Sutter's arm, spinning him round, and took out five or six others with my Colts. Colin did the same. We just kept right on riding through the camp, screaming and giving our rebel yells.
And you both got away?
We got away. Colin took a rifle bullet to his chest. It took him 4 days to die. 4 days of pain and agony as we hid from the bluebellies in swamps and creek bottoms while they searched for us.
Did you kill Sutter?
Not then. He survived that wound. Took me another year and a half before I finally stood face to face with him and blew him to hell for what he done that day. When those soldiers shot my friends down like that, they became no better than animals and deserved what they got.
Kinda like those bandidos of Murdoch's.
Yep.
Bandidos?
When Joey didn't answer, Smoke told Cal and Pearlie about how the Rurales and Apaches raided Joey's ranch and wounded his wife and son, and how Joey planned to make them pay for what they had done.
But you can't go up against an entire gang of 30 or 40 men by yourself.
He isn't going to be alone. I intend to be there with him.
Oh, now that ain't my plan, Smoke.
I know. But seeing as how I'd be lying in Big Rock with my brains decorating the dirt if you hadn't taken a hand, I'm obligated to return the favor.
But it...
No buts, Joey. It's a matter of honor. And two men stand a better chance of coming out of this alive than only one.
And four men stand a better chance than two. Cal and I'd be proud to ride with you and Smoke, Joey.
Thank you, boys. But a man's got to kill his own snakes and saddle his own horse.
Except when a snake needs killing. Don't matter much who kills it, long as it gets killed. Now, when do we ride?
Now this boy is plumb full of piss and vinegar. I tell you what, I'll mosey on over to Pueblo. If I see I can't get the job done alone, I'll send for you boys first thing.
If that's your last word, we'll have to accept your wishes. But I still think you're making a big mistake.
Won't be the first I made.
Now you two rough and tumble pistoliers get on over to that bunkhouse and get some sleep. Daylight's gonna come mighty early, and you still got some fences to mend before first snowfall.
The two young men took off toward the bunkhouse with disappointed glances back over their shoulders.
You got a couple of good boys there, Smoke. They kin of yours?
Nah, just got lucky, I guess.
Awful lucky, I'd say.